Let's talk sports. This is Kent Batty, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Today I'll be reading from the USA Today Sports Weekly for the week of December 17th through the 23rd. We'll start with something from Pro Football from Jarrett Bell, columnist for USA Today. So this is how it ends. Patrick Mahomes was knocked out of the loss that eliminated the Kansas City Chiefs in the waning moments of the game with a wicked left knee injury. There was no cape for Superman to put on to save the Chiefs' kingdom this time on Sunday, December 14th. Rats, oh, you know how he tried. But the knee buckled and bent awkwardly. He lay on the turf in apparent anguish as the medical team administered treatment. Teammates went down to one knee. It was a somber scene at Arrowhead Stadium. Mahomes, who also has demonstrated repeatedly that he is as great as it gets, is human after all. The Chiefs needed him to spark a last-minute rally for a game-tying field goal or even a winning touchdown, but there was nothing left. Oh, you know he was game. Mahomes scored the only Chiefs touchdown during the 16-13 loss to the Chargers, and for much of the game was his team's leading rusher. This was part of the problem. Too often they've relied on him to do too much. He won't win the NFL's MVP award this season, but he deserves it nevertheless, because without him, and with all due respect to the often proficient Steve Spagnuolo-coordinated defense that allowed just 16 points, his team was toast. He provided heart, soul, energy, hope, and logic that with the Chiefs' season on the line and the remarkable streak of 7 consecutive trips to the AFC Championship game in the mix, there was still a chance to make a miracle run, until there wasn't. Minutes after the game, the ominous tone from Chiefs coach Andy Reid strongly hinted that the star quarterback was done for the year. "It doesn't look good," Reid said during his post-game news conference. The Chiefs followed on Sunday night with official confirmation that Mahomes suffered a torn ACL. A statement from the team added, "Patrick and the club are exploring surgical options." First things first, hail to the Chiefs. This is the first time that Kansas City at 6-8 won't be in the AFC playoffs since Mahomes became the starter. And it's the first time the Chiefs have lost at least 8 games in a season since 2012, when they were 2-14 before Reid became coach. With Mahomes, the Chiefs won 3 Super Bowls and played in 2 others. In a parity-laden league leveled out by a salary cap, the Chiefs managed to keep winning, keep competing for crowns to establish their own dynasty in the aftermath of the New England Patriots run powered by Tom Brady and Bill Belichick. Now this. Mahomes gamely limped off the field to the bench under his own power after suffering his injury. And intentional or not, it was some kind of statement about the determination and pride that any of us who have watched him over the years realize runs so deep through his blood. Minutes later, though, CBS's cameras captured his journey to the locker room. Mahomes couldn't get there on his own. He was helped up the tunnel with medical staffers holding him up on both sides like human crutches. Sadly, this moment symbolized how this chapter, if not this era, ends for the proud franchise that is now so battered. Sure, Holmes is the face of the Chiefs, but that was a dose of unintended insults added to injury. The Chiefs didn't just lose, they lost their main man in the process. With Mahomes knocked out of the contest, the Chiefs turned to Gardner Minshew, the backup quarterback without so much as a cape. Minshew came in and promptly moved the chains with a short completion to Travis Kelce. Good idea, good execution. Then the Chiefs were flagged for a delay of game, with the poor execution of just getting the snap off reflected by the lack of urgency that you'd never see from Mahomes in this situation. The next play, Minshew threw a lazy pass toward Kelce into double, or was it triple, coverage that was intercepted, of course, by Darwin James. In other words, no Mahomes, no chance. A weird January is coming in 2026. The last time the Chiefs weren't in the AFC Championship game? Try 2017, way back on pre-pandemic Earth. Maybe it is indeed the end of an era for the Chiefs, whose streak of 9 consecutive AFC West titles was snapped. It's certainly more than a mere speed bump. Suddenly this season, a team that knew how to win in crunch time, the Chiefs were 12-0 in one-score games last season, and set an NFL record by winning 17 consecutive one-score games. They couldn't win the close ones this year. On Sunday, the Chiefs fell to 1-7 this season in one-score games. What next? There are glaring gaps with the running game and the pass rush. And who knows how much longer Kelce will play after mulling retirement last offseason. Yet, with Mahomes being Mahomes, and it is apparent that rehab will dominate his offseason, they can still build around the quintessential centerpiece. Yet, nothing is automatic. As spectacular as Mahomes has been over the years, it was never automatic that he'd lead another Super Bowl run, even though it might have seemed that way. That he was always packing a superhero cape. Now, it's not automatic that the Chiefs will quickly bounce back as a contender. For a change, the Chiefs will have a long offseason to deal with their issues. Now let's see what Nate Davis can tell us about the 32 things he learned this week in the NFL. 0. The number of points scored Sunday by the Cincinnati Bengals in a game they had to win in order to remain in the postseason fringes. Remarkably, the Stripes took the bagel against the Baltimore Ravens despite running 71 plays and holding the ball for nearly 40 minutes. A virtual impossible set of circumstances. It was the first time the Bengals have been shut out since 2017. So much for tying up so much money in quarterback Joe Burrow and wide receivers Ja'Marr Chase and T. Higgins, though the latter was unable to play after returning to the concussion protocol for the second time in 3 weeks. 1. The number of times the Kansas City Chiefs have missed the playoffs in the last decade. That regrettable outcome clinched with Sunday's loss to the Los Angeles Chargers. The last time KC fell short was 2014, and coach Andy Reid's second season with the club. 2. The number of teams that clinched playoff berths on Sunday. The first secured this season. The Los Angeles Rams and Denver Broncos both punching their tickets to the Super Bowl 60 tournament. Neither team has yet to win its division, but both are in position to win their respective conference's number one seed. 3. The number of teams officially eliminated Sunday. The Minnesota Vikings falling by the wayside, well, long before they took the field Sunday night, along with the Chiefs and Bengals. 4. But Sunday was a very painful one beyond the league's shifting playoff ramifications. Several superstars suffering injuries likely to run the gamut as it pertains to long-term consequences. 5. Chiefs quarterback Patrick Mahomes suffered a torn ACL near the end of the Kansas City loss, an injury that would have ensured that he wouldn't play in the AFC Championship game for the first time since he became the team's starter in 2018, though KC's loss had also certified that outcome. One of the more remarkable runs in league history comes to an end on that front. 6. Green Bay Packers defensive end Micah Parsons may have suffered a similar fate as Mahomes, and his loss would be far more damaging in the context of this season, given the Packers have had the look of a team that could win the Super Bowl. 7. The Pack were up 23-21 at the end of the third quarter when Parsons went down in Denver. Not only did they eventually succumb 34-26, but the loss dropped them from second place overall in the conference and first in the NFC North to 7th, although 1.5 games up on the still dangerous Lions. 8. The length of the Washington Commanders' losing streak entering Sunday, before they snapped it by beating the Giants 29-21. 9. The length of the Giants' losing streak after losing to the Commanders. 10. Yay, NFC East, which will almost certainly have its first repeat division winner since 2004 after the Philadelphia Eagles pillaged the Las Vegas Raiders 31-0. Yet, even the reigning champs currently seem like the least bad team of the largely uninspiring quartet. 11. Speaking of concerning injuries, the Rams have their own relative level of concern, despite locking up a playoff berth. But wide receiver Devontae Adams' hamstring injury could be a huge setback, especially with LA set to play at Seattle on Thursday night. 12. Currently, even with an 11-3 record, though the Rams beat the Seahawks in Week 11, Thursday night's winner will not only move to the top of the NFC West, but also takes possession of the conference's number one seed. Seattle certainly appears to be the healthier team, if a slightly more erratic one, than LA. 13. Commanders linebacker Von Miller's place on the NFL's all-time sack list, the stat became official in 82, after he reached 136.5 on Sunday. Not all on that same day, by the way. Miller moved a half sack ahead of Hall of Famer Jared Allen. 14. What a day for Jacksonville Jaguars quarterback Trevor Lawrence, who threw a career-high 5 TD passes in the AFC South leaders' 48-20 rout of the New York Jets. Lawrence also rushed for 51 yards and another score. It's almost like this guy should have been a number one overall draft pick. Oh, wait. 15. If the season ended today, the New York Giants would own the number one pick of the 2026 draft. 16. But it sure looks like the Raiders, who fell from the number one spot to number two this weekend, might have to make the G-Men an offer. Las Vegas gained all of 75 yards total at Philadelphia en route to its seventh consecutive loss. 17. The longtime jersey number of the Indianapolis Colts quarterback Phil Rivers, with the permission of predecessor Daniel Jones and the league, which he wore on Sunday at Seattle. 18. The number of seasons River has now played in the league, by virtue of being on the Colts' active roster, to say nothing of playing an entire game at Lauman Field, that's Lumen Field, and Rivers, 44, provided a valiant effort while passing for 120 yards and a TD in an 18-16 loss to mighty Seattle, with just a few days of prep and 5 years of rust and extra weight. Even if all this hullabaloo will keep him out of the Hall of Fame now until at least, 2031. 19. But while Indy maybe got a shot of adrenaline and hope that this season can be salvaged, the reality is that the Colts at 8-6 continue to spiral after their 7-1 start and are starting to cement themselves into 8th place in the AFC, not where any team wants to be, particularly one that's reaching for the brass ring. 20. Tennessee Titans quarterback Cam Ward has thrown multiple TD passes in successive weeks after he hadn't done it all season prior to December. Didn't help his team avoid a 37-24 loss to the 49ers, but it's progress. 21.5. The number of sacks Cleveland Browns defensive end Myles Garrett now has, extending what was already his career high after he registered 1.5 Sunday at Chicago. 22.5. Garrett needs just one more quarterback takedown to tie the single season record shared by TJ Watt and Hall of Famer Michael Strahan. 23. The jersey number of Rams running back Kyron Williams, he had 88 total yards and 2 TDs, who had a much bigger day than Lions counterpart Jahmyr Gibbs, a big key to LA's victory. Gibbs had 58 yards and didn't manage to score as Detroit continued to lose touch with the NFC playoff field. However, this is number 24, Lions wide receiver Amon-Ra St. Brown had himself a day, 13 catches, 164 yards, and 2 TDs. The Southern Cal product shining near his old haunting grounds, even if he wasn't able to produce a victory. 25. But it did produce a spot for ARSB in the record books, the Detroit star becoming the first player to record at least 90 receptions in each of his first 5 NFL seasons. 26. The jersey number of Houston's Texans running back Jawar Jordan, a second-year player who made his regular season debut Sunday after being promoted from the practice squad just 24 hours earlier, and he rushed for 101 yards on 15 carries. 27. Guess who will be the number one pick on your fantasy waiver wire this week? 28. More important, if Jordan can actually be a factor in a Houston offense that got a 3-TD passing day from quarterback C.J. Stroud in Sunday's 40-20 defeat of the Cardinals, this team could legitimately be the AFC's best by the time the playoffs start. 29. The Texans, who are 9-5, remain on track to become the fifth team since 1990 to qualify for postseason despite an 0-3 start. Number 30. It's been a tough year for the Cardinals, but it will wind up a significant one for tight end Trey McBride, who had 12 catches for 134 yards and 2 TDs in their defeat on Sunday. The receptions and TDs matched McBride's personal bests in an NFL game, while the yardage total beat his previous career high by 1 yard. 31. McBride now has a league-best 105 receptions and became the first tight end in league history to hit the century mark in successive years. McBride and Travis Kelce are the only tight ends with multiple 100-catch seasons in the NFL, Kelce managing it 3 times. With 12 catches over the final 3 games, McBride will break Zach Ertz's season record for tight end catches. 32. And with his 16th consecutive game with at least 5 receptions, McBride set a new positional record after being tied on that front with Kelce. And here's another NFL short feature article by Chris Bumbaca with USA Today. The New England Patriots made the big plays and ran the ball as well as the team ever has. Rookie running back Travion Henderson had 2 touchdowns and more than 50 yards. Quarterback Drake May had 2 rushing scores for the first time in his young career. And the Pats set a team record by averaging 9.8 yards per attempt, 246 yards total. In the grand scheme of the season and playoffs, none of it mattered much. The Patriots still fell to the Buffalo Bills 35-31 on Sunday. The loss snapped their 10-game winning streak. It also meant the hat and t-shirt plans to celebrate their first AFC East title since 2019 had to be delayed until at least next week when a Sunday night football matchup against the Ravens looms. I think it's tough to look back at all the other things, but this definitely can kind of be a kick in the butt, tight end Hunter Henry said. We've had things go our way and everything go our way the last 10 weeks, so this is definitely a reality check. That's a good football team. We went toe-to-toe with them in every aspect, but we have to give them credit. We've got to get a lot better from this fast. The issue for New England was primarily the inability to stop the Bills after the first quarter. Mike Vrabel's team forced 3 punts to start the game. The Patriots then proceeded to watch the Bills, led by reigning MVP Josh Allen with 3 passing touchdowns at quarterback, scored 5 consecutive touchdowns, a 21-0 first half lead accomplished after a 52-yard sprint by Henderson and a 24-7 advantage evaporated. We were going to need 60 minutes to beat this team, Vrabel said. Instead, the offense supplied a sublime and efficient first 30. May waltzed into the end zone 2 times in the first quarter. There are throws May wants back, but the lesson from this loss is more obvious, he said. At the end of the day, got to keep the foot on the pedal and keep it going and kind of don't let them dictate. It starts with me, he said. And we kind of felt during the week that we had a chance this was going to happen and just got to keep our foot on the pedal. It happened in the first game. They came back and came back. May was referencing the Patriots' Week 5 victory when they took a 20-10 lead early in the fourth quarter, only to have Buffalo tie it 10 minutes later. The difference between the two outcomes is that May and the offense sustained a drive at the end of the game to give Andy Borgalis a chance to kick the game-winning field goal. This time, however, May couldn't make the clutch play. After Henderson's TD run, the Pats went 3 and out and turned the ball over on downs on their final possession. May lacked the confidence he often exudes that makes him look like a 10-year veteran, let alone somebody with just 26 career starts. We just have to be better when we're up, May said. It starts with me making some throws. And from there, like Coach says, no naps, no relaxing. I didn't feel like we relaxed. We just didn't make enough plays. Credit to them. The story of the game wouldn't be complete without involvement from the referees. After Henderson retook the lead for the Pats, the Bills faced a 3rd and 4 from near midfield. Allen looked to deliver the ball to Keon Coleman, who was battling cornerback Carlton Davis. Davis broke the play up, but one of the back judges ruled the corner had tugged on Coleman's jersey from behind. Vrabel wouldn't assign blame to anyone other than his own team. 2 plays later, Cook sliced his way into the end zone for the go-ahead score. All that came after another questionable pass interference call on quarterback Marcus Jones, despite Khalil Shakir coming down with a 37-yard completion anyway, as the Bills trailed 24-21. We just played a playoff game, the first one, and that's cool because it wasn't a real playoff game. But the stakes were kind of a playoff thing, Davis said. Like I said, it's good for us to learn from this and make some corrections going into the backstretch. So let's turn now to some college football highlights with the playoffs beginning this week and with the bowl game starting as well. So first, we'll talk about the playoff first round. Game number one on this chart is Friday, the 19th. It has number 9, Alabama, at number 8, Oklahoma. Alabama is 10-3. Oklahoma is 10-2. And the spread right now has Alabama by 1. Not surprisingly, these big-name programs get the Friday primetime treatment to kick off the first round of the college football playoff. It's the first of 2 opening round contests that are rematches. The Sooners took the first encounter 23-21 on November 15th, the primary reason OU earned hosting privileges for the encore. The Crimson Tide offense has not been especially sharp over the past month, a stretch that includes the initial loss to the Sooners and the blowout loss to Georgia in the SEC title game. Quarterback Ty Simpson still has a lot of speed weapons in his arsenal, like wide receiver Ryan Williams, but he has been getting little ground support, and linebacker Kip Lewis and the rest of the Sooners front will look to continue that. OU has also struggled to find points, and quarterback John Mateer has become pick-prone, trying to force the ball into traffic. Alabama safety Bray Hubbard will be ready to pounce on any errant throws. Prediction? In all likelihood, we're in for another defensive slog. The team that gets the most opportunities with a short field will slip by, and the Tide will be able to create more such chances. Prediction, Alabama 20-14. This next game is on the 20th, Saturday that is, and it pits number 10 Miami at 10-2 against number 7 Texas A&M at 11-1, and the spread has Texas A&M by 3.5 points. This is arguably the most intriguing of the opening round quartet of CFP games. Both the Aggies and the Hurricanes are in the 12-team field for the first time, and both are here in large measure, that is, because of September victories against Notre Dame. Miami quarterback Carson Beck is accustomed to the big stage from his time at Georgia, though he can still make critical mistakes at inopportune moments. If he is on target, wide receiver Malachi Toney could take advantage of an Aggies secondary that can be susceptible at times. A&M defensive end Cassius Howell will try to keep him off balance. Aggies quarterback Marcel Reed can be streaky, but has outstanding playmakers like wide receivers KC Concepcion and Mario Craver at his disposal. The Hurricanes have a disruptive force of their own in defensive end Reuben Bain, who often gets help from the opposite side from Achim Mesidor. Prediction? The Aggies have been slow out of the gate of late, but the Hurricanes are notorious for not holding leads. As such, this one could come down to the wire, so we'll go with A&M getting the needed boost from its famous home crowd. Texas A&M 28-27. The next game in the playoffs is number 11, Tulane, who are 11-2. Playing at Ole Miss, number 6, which is 11-1. The betting spread has Ole Miss by 17.5. This is the second playoff pairing. By the way, this game is also on Saturday. This is the second playoff pairing of the teams that met in the regular season. The first encounter was not especially competitive as the Rebels romped at 45-10, but the Green Wave had rolled to double-digit wins in their past four outings, including the American Championship final against North Texas. Tulane quarterback Jake Retzlaff has five receivers with at least 23 catches, and he might need all of them to keep the ball moving against defensive tackle Will Eccles and the Ole Miss defense. Rebels quarterback Trinidad Chambliss and running back Kewan Lacy found the end zone early and often in their prior meeting with the Green Wave. The Tulane defense might again be overmatched, but safety Jack Chichu can usually be found at the point of attack. Prediction: despite the departure of Lane Giffen that has Ole Miss in an unusual position, there's little to suggest this meeting with the Green Wave will unfold any differently from the first one. It might take a quarter or two, but the Rebels will take charge, Ole Miss 31-14. Our last playoff game of this weekend, also a Saturday game at night, 7:30, has number 12 James Madison at 12-1 playing at Oregon, number 5, who is 11-1. The Sun Belt champion Dukes have made the toughest, oh, by the way, Oregon's favored by 21.5. The Sun Belt champion Dukes have the toughest of assignments as they make their playoff debut on the opposite coast against the battle-tested Ducks. You won't hear any complaining from JMU, however, even as a heavy underdog. JMU's backfield tandem of quarterback Alonzo Barrett III and running back Wayne Knight do a good job staying on schedule, enabling a 47.67 conversion rate on third down and a time of possession advantage over 8 minutes a game. Finding gaps might be more difficult this week against the likes of the Ducks linebacker Bruce Betcher, Oregon quarterback Dante Moore, and running back Noah Whittington also know how to keep the sticks moving, but their blockers must account for Duke's defensive end, Sahir West. Prediction: most viewers across the country will be pulling for the Dukes as the plucky underdogs, but the crowd in Autzen Stadium will have other ideas. In any event, the Ducks are simply more talented across the board and will make short work of this one, Oregon 45-20. Now here's just a quick rundown of the other bowl games this week. The Cure Bowl in Orlando, Florida pits Old Dominion at 9-3 against South Florida at 9-3. I don't know myself what the Cure is for, but I'm sure it's worthy. The 68 Ventures Bowl is in Mobile, Alabama, and that pits Delaware against Louisiana Lafayette. These are both on Wednesday. The Xbox Bowl is in Frisco, Texas, and it pits Arkansas State at 6-6 versus Missouri State at 7-5. The spread has Arkansas State by 5.5. The Myrtle Beach Bowl, which is in Conway, South Carolina, pits Kennesaw State at 10-3 against Western Michigan at 9-4. Western Michigan is favored by 3.5. The Gasparilla Bowl in Tampa pits Memphis versus NC State. Memphis is 8-4. NC State is 7-5 and is favored by 6. The famous Idaho Potato Bowl in Boise pits Utah State at 6-6 versus Washington State at 6-6. Maybe this should be the mediocre Idaho Potato Bowl. Anyway, Utah State favored by 3. The Boca Raton Bowl, which of course is in Florida, pits Louisville at 8-4 versus Toledo at 8-4, and Louisville's favored by 8.5. The New Orleans Bowl has Southern Mississippi 7-5 versus Western Kentucky 8-4, and Western is favored by 4. And last bowl this week is the Frisco, Texas Bowl. It has Ohio State at 8-4 versus UNLV at 10-3, and UNLV is favored by 4.5 points. Well, as long as we're talking about upcoming football games, let's look at the key NFL Week 16 matchups. The first one to highlight is the Rams at 11-3 playing the Seahawks, also at 11-3, a big game. The Rams are favored by only 1. The next highlight I have is the Packers at 9-4-1 playing at the Bears at 10-4. And in this one, the Packers are favored by only 1.5 points. The next one of general highlighting interest has the Chargers playing at the Cowboys. And the Chargers are 10-4 and the Cowboys are only 6-7-1. And the spread has the Cowboys, believe it or not, by 1.5. There are only three more games that have any real significance to most of us. The next one has the Jaguars at 10-4 playing at the Broncos, who are 12-2. And the Broncos are favored by 3 points. I will mention that the Cardinals, a meager 3-11, playing at home against the Falcons, 5-9, and the Falcons are favored by 2.5. Next, we have the Steelers at 8-6, playing at the Lions, also 8-6, a key game in both divisions, and the Lions are favored by 7. And then finally, we have the Patriots at 11-3, playing at the Ravens at 7-7. And the Ravens, however, are favored by 3. Next, we'll skip back to another special interest story on the college football front. This is by Jenny Carlson, who's with the Oklahoman, but also USA Today Network. Beating a team twice in the same season is tough, so says the Department of Sports armchair philosophy. Not sure if the armchair philosophers will have a mantra for what Oklahoma will try to do against Alabama in the first round of the college football playoff, though. Not only will the Sooners try to beat the Crimson Tide twice in the same season, but they will also try to beat it for the third time in less than 13 months. Tough? Sure. But here's a competing bit of armchair philosophy. What if Brent Venables has Kalen DeBoer's number? No doubt the sample size is small. Even though Venables has been dialing up defenses for decades and DeBoer has been calling offenses for a long time too, the two masterminds have only gone head-to-head twice. But the evidence is strong for Venables. You remember the games, of course. The first one came last season in Norman. Venables and his Sooners were in the midst of a woeful season while DeBoer and his Crimson Tide were trying to get themselves to the SEC championship game and the college football playoff. Led by Heisman contender Jalen Milroe, Alabama had an offense that had scored at least 40 points in 6 of its first 10 games. But that November night against Venables' defense, DeBoer's offense had as many interceptions as points. Now, a quick aside, Zach Alley was technically the OU defensive coordinator a year ago, and he was technically calling plays too. But at the least, Venables' fingerprints were all over the defense, and at most, he made most of the calls against Alabama. Safe to say, it was more Venables versus DeBoer than Alley versus DeBoer. And Venables and the Sooner defense were dominant in a 24-3 win. In addition to those 3 interceptions, they had 9 tackles for loss and 4 quarterback hurries. They befuddled Milroe and pretty much ended any chance he had of even being a Heisman finalist. The same could be said of Ty Simpson. Last month, when OU rolled into Tuscaloosa, the Alabama quarterback was in the Heisman conversation. But by the time the Sooner Schooner headed home with a 23-21 victory, Simpson was another Crimson Tide signal caller wondering what the heck Venables and the Sooner defense had done to him. Simpson threw a pick 6, was sacked 4 times, and hurried 4 more times. All told, the Alabama offense turned the ball over 3 times and had more 3-and-outs, 4, than scoring drives, 3. And when the Crimson Tide turned the momentum early in the second half and took a 21-20 lead, the Sooner defense tightened the clamps. During the final 20 minutes of the game, Alabama managed only 57 yards and never crossed midfield. The result of the 4 possessions during that stretch, 3-and-out, punt, fumble, 3-and-out, punt, turnover on downs. The Crimson Tide had no answers for what Venables and the Sooners did. That includes DeBoer. We always talk about you create your own breaks, make your own breaks by playing hard and playing smart and playing fast, DeBoer said recently on a college football playoff conference call. And that's certainly what Coach Venables has with his team and the defense. DeBoer was nothing but complimentary of Venables in the OU defense. One of the best in the country, DeBoer said. But he has to be racking his brain trying to figure out how to beat Venables. Sure, taking care of the ball would be big for Alabama, which has turned over the ball 6 times in these past 2 games. But when an offense is uncomfortable, it becomes susceptible to those kinds of mistakes. And pretty clearly, Venables has the Crimson Tide uncomfortable. By the way, the 2-game winning streak that OU is riding against Alabama is no small thing. Georgia has only won 2 of its last 5 games against Bama, Ole Miss 2 of its last 10, Tennessee 2 of its last 4, LSU 2 of its last 7, even Auburn, with all of its Iron Bowl wizardry, has only beaten Bama in 2 of its last 7 drives. Teams just don't beat the Crimson Tide in back-to-back seasons. Venables and the Sooners have. For his part, Venables says he doesn't think these past matchups will have any impact on the playoff game. Obviously, we have tendencies. They have tendency, he said. They have certain matchups they like. We have certain matchups we like. At the end of the day, you can throw all that out. It's time to start completely over. Color me skeptical on that last bit. Oh, nothing Venables and the Sooners have done against the Crimson Tide will score any points or snag any interceptions or force any fumbles next Friday. But any time a defensive coordinator builds a catalog on an opponent, what it does well and what its tendencies are, as well as what the best counters are and what causes the most trouble, well, that's an advantage. And for a defensive coordinator as good as Venables, that's huge. All that matters is what you do moving forward, Venables said. What he and the OU defense do will determine not only if the Sooners beat the Crimson Tide twice in the same season and thrice in a little over a year, but also if he has more than DeBoer's number. Venables may have a rent-free residence in DeBoer's head. Well, it's time for one more special interest story from college football. And this is a sad one for many of us, especially those who have been Big Ten fans. The distance from a football stadium to a jail cell can be vast, until it's not. Just a few miles, actually, if you're measuring by a car's odometer and following Stadium Boulevard in Ann Arbor eastward from Michigan Stadium. Merge onto Washtenaw Avenue and you're nearly halfway to 14A1 District Court, a near straight shot from the indelible football home of the maize and blue. Sherrone Moore's journey between these two spots this past week took a more circuitous route, of course. That he took the trek shouldn't be shocking. Not because the world is full of soothsayers who predicted the former Michigan football coach's downfall, but because Moore is a member of the human species, and this is what we do. And yet, such journeys remain jarring, especially when faced with the juxtaposition of a sudden change in reality, as Moore is experiencing now, as anyone who has followed his slide from grace this past week. One moment someone is leading a football team out of a tunnel while the marching band plays, the next moment they're wearing an electronic tether and told not to leave the state. 4 days before he appeared on a monitor in that Washtenaw County District Courtroom on Friday the 12th, dressed in white, motionless, hands bound and resting on his lap, an apparition, Moore stood at a lectern inside Schembechler Hall in the shadow of Michigan Stadium to talk about an impending Citrus Bowl trip to Orlando, Florida. Sun, green grass, a New Year's Eve date against Texas. The future. He was the head coach of Michigan football. Earlier that day, Monday, the U of M staffer with whom Moore was allegedly having a years-long intimate relationship broke it off, according to a Washtenaw County prosecutor. Moore, the prosecutor said on Friday, sent a barrage of texts to the staffer she didn't answer, blitzed her with calls she didn't want, overwhelmed her until she finally told officials at U of M what its football coach was doing and allegedly what they had done. The school fired Moore on Wednesday. At some point soon after receiving the news, said First Assistant Prosecutor Katie Rasmirsky, he came to her apartment, barged his way in, proceeded to a kitchen door, grabbed several butter knives and a pair of kitchen scissors, and began to threaten his own life, and told the staffer, according to Rasmussen, "I'm going to kill myself. I'm going to make you watch. Your blood is on my hands. You ruined my life." He terrorized her, Rasmussen told the magistrate in court. The staffer called her attorney and threatened to call the police. Moore eventually left and was later arrested near a church in Saline by Pittsfield Township Police. That's south of Ann Arbor. Then taken to Trinity Health Ann Arbor Hospital for a psychiatric evaluation and eventually to the Washtenaw County Jail. He spent two nights there, then showed up on that monitor in Washtenaw County Whites on Friday afternoon, 4 days after wearing Michigan blue inside Schembechler Hall as the face of the University of Michigan. 4 days. From bowl game prep to charges of third-degree felony home invasion, from talk of hiring a quarterback coach to misdemeanor stalking, from the chance to write a relatively blah season to misdemeanor breaking and entering, from coaching at one of the most iconic programs in college sports to being shown on a courtroom monitor in a room packed with reporters for a different kind of reason, ringed with six Washtenaw County law enforcement officers. Moore is no stranger to those officers. Well, not specifically those officers, but the colleagues of those officers who wear the same county uniform and not so long ago helped protect him among all those rabid fans on Saturdays in the fall. That's a stunning change of vantage point from protectee to captee, even for a sport that's no stranger to the absurd and banal impropriety. Moore might still be Michigan's coach if he hadn't reacted to the end of the relationship the way he allegedly did on Monday. Or maybe not. Maybe the truth would have come out eventually and he'd have been out as the U of M's football leader anyway. Even so, it's the reaction and lack of self-control in that reaction, according to court testimony, that led him to jail, and thus led him to the top of the news cycle wherever sports are covered across the country. For better and for worse, plenty of coaches find their way back to coaching after inappropriate relationships. But home invasion and threatening to kill yourself with a butter knife? That'll rattle around the sports collective memory for a while, and will almost certainly keep Moore off a college sideline far into the future, far more than the two-year show cause edict by the NCAA handing down a few months ago. Oh, someone else will eventually bump him from the cycle, no doubt. Sooner rather than later, if you're wagering on your own species, it's what we do, right? That doesn't make it any less sad and messy for Moore's family, for the U of M staffer with whom he allegedly partnered, for the football program and those who love the school, for fans who adore the sport. Moore looked folded into himself on that jail cell camera, a dream-turned nightmare of his own making. If nothing else, he'll have time to look inward. He was released on a $25,000 bond late Friday afternoon. And while that can be an unnerving thought for any of us, it can often lead to a place a little more settled. That journey takes a lot longer than the one that led him from Schembechler Hall to district court. It always does. This article was written by Sean Windsor with the Detroit Free Press. Well, folks, for some unusual reason, I guess, this paper this week doesn't have any stories about basketball, pro or college. So I apologize for that. But it does have several stories about Major League Baseball in the offseason. So we'll start with one from Gabe Lax. After an encouraging start, Major League Baseball's offseason has stalled out, kind of like an unwanted weather pattern. Its winter meetings produced a pair of semi-blockbuster deals for Kyle Schwarber and Pete Alonso, yet a lot more of the groundwork laying more associated with the general manager's meetings 1 month earlier. Sure, those chats and texts can bear fruit, evidenced by the run on relief pitchers continuing in the hours after the meeting. Yet, industry-wide momentum will prove elusive until a handful of situations are settled or franchises move definitively in a certain direction. Let's take a look at five agenda items that can go a long way toward producing a winter wonderland of transactions as the holiday season continues. A destination for Kyle Tucker. Yep, that'd be nice. It's not often the postseason works in top-down fashion, though it's also not out of the question that the winner's consensus top free agent signs before, during, or shortly after the winter meetings. There has been precious little smoke on Tucker, however, other than the decreasing likelihood that the two-time defending champion Los Angeles Dodgers will be in play for the slugging corner outfielder. And for some clubs, such as the Toronto Blue Jays, Tucker, who's been worth between 4.6 and 5.3 WAR in every full season of his career, doesn't necessarily represent an either-or proposition. They can simply shift around what they have. Think Addison Barger, Ernie Clement, and company, without any major adds. Yet, for some clubs, engaging with Tucker and either succeeding or failing in that pursuit might determine several other paths, which brings us to the Yankees do something. General manager Brian Cashman was generally both coy and vague in his media briefings, exiting the meetings by noting that there was not a lot of the inventory I'm interested in coming off the board yet. And owner Hal Steinbrenner seems to indicate both the Yankees are still at the forefront of player investment, while also warning that the till may not be totally open. Still, there's always time for the biggest market team to put together a stealth attack on a player like Tucker, who won't command Soto money yet, but will still end up with a larger guarantee than, say, Aaron Judge. Inflation these days, right? Closer to home, though, a Tucker resolution would also provide a lot more clarity for Cody Bellinger, whom the Yankees would like to retain, though not necessarily at a boutique price. Agent Scott Boras's thinly coded assessment of Bellinger's robust market indicates there could be a flock of very serious suitors, and it stands to reason exploiting the Tucker losers would maximize the return for his client. The Yankees say they both need to close the gap on the Blue Jays, yet are quick to note that they won the same amount of games, 94, in the regular season before Toronto flattened them in the American League Division Series. So it's not a damn the torpedoes winner in the Bronx, yet things must be done, right? Starting pitchers. Who wants one? Proving that there are no off-season absolutes, this was one market that did, in fact, unfold top-down. Dylan Cease's $210 million pact with Toronto was agreed to before Thanksgiving, which one might intuit would spark a mini frenzy in an area of import that's always short on inventory. Yet, since then, nada, unless Michael Soroka to the Diamondbacks warms your hot stove. A semi-informed decision, the next two pitchers on the board, left-handers Framber Valdez and Ranger Suarez, aren't the sort of arms a club would necessarily build its off-season around. Their markets will percolate and finally heat up, but it might not be until the other clubs have exhausted other options or areas of greater need. For instance, the Orioles might engage more furtively with Valdez now that Alonso has been secured for 5 years and $155 million. And once Valdez and Suarez go, the rest should follow with some rapidity, from the Zach Gallens and the Michael Kings all the way down to the 40-something horses, Max Scherzer and Justin Verlander. Next subject, homes for Munetaka Murakami and Tatsuya Imai. Hey, finally some hard and fast deadlines. The slugging Murakami and the right-hander Imai are the biggest prizes posted from Japan this season, and the clock is ticking on their 45-day windows to sign with a major league club. Murakami must sign by 5 p.m. Eastern Time on the 22nd, and he shouldn't have a problem finding a fairly large deal with a club willing to bet his 246 home runs in 8 seasons in Japan will translate nicely to the big leagues. Imai should face an even more robust market. Teams have until January 2nd to reel in a 27-year-old who struck out 178 batters in only 163 and two-thirds innings with a 1.92 ERA and what figures to be his last season in Japan. Sure, that's a ways out still, but At least there's a defined endgame looming for both these guys. Next, the Cardinals. Trade somebody? St. Louis and Nolan Arenado are staging a stirring remake of The Long Kiss Goodbye, starring a third baseman with a no-trade clause who can't find the right fit. The Cardinals thought they had him dealt a year ago, then played another season with the 10-time Gold Glover. At this point, nobody's waiting with bated breath for this deal. Brendan Donovan? Now that's another story. A 2025 All-Star second baseman who can toggle to two or three positions and 2 years remaining on his free agency? No wonder the Cardinals were popular with several teams at the meetings, particularly those who might want to plug a second base vacancy without the long-term commitment to slugger Ketel Marte. The Cardinals certainly got the ball rolling on their teardown by dealing pitcher Sonny Gray to the Boston Red Sox. Now, if they can find a landing spot for Donovan, and the Giants, Mariners, Astros, and others have kicked the tires, that could greatly stimulate the market. Now let's hear an analysis of the Pete Alonso trade deal. This is by Gabe Blacks. Like trains passing each other en route from one city's Penn Station to the other, the fortunes of the Baltimore Orioles and the New York Mets changed in an instant on December 10th. Pete Alonso is southbound to Camden Yards. The deal will have significant repercussions as the Orioles continue a focused and determined roster upgrade, while the Mets, for the moment, appear flat-footed as they aim to bounce back from a desultory conclusion to the 25 season. Alonso's five-year, $155 million deal is a relative bargain for a guy who's belted at least 40 home runs in three of his six full seasons, who will be just 35 years old when the contract ends, whose glue guy ethos will readily galvanize Baltimore's clubhouse. Let's take a look at the winners and losers of the Polar Bears migration. The winners, Adley Rutschman, Gunnar Henderson and company. There was once a time you couldn't type these guys' names without dropping best young core in the game in there. A season and a half of collective digression gradually altered that narrative, particularly for Rutschman, who fell into a sinkhole halfway through the 24 season and never got out. Yet, perhaps, all the 20-somethings needed was a veteran anchor. Alonso will more than provide that. He'll slide his right-handed bat right into the cleanup spot at Camden Yards, likely between Henderson and Rutschman. Immediately, the pressure to produce should lessen, and Alonso will tote with him 7 years of battle tales playing in New York. In a clubhouse missing a consistent voice, the Polar Bear can provide that as well. The entire squad should be uplifted, on and off the field. Another winner, Mike Elias. After a meh offseason a year ago led to a 75-87 disaster, the architect of Baltimore's extreme teardown and highly successful buildup was starting to lose his shine in Charm City, where fans wondered if 300 lost seasons in 4 years was really worth it. Yet, he insisted owner David Rubenstein, in his second full year at the helm, okayed enough resources to get a significant bat and, more important, an arm or two for the rotation. The Alonso get, as big as it is on the field, serves as a significant reassurance to both the clubhouse and fan base that the franchise is in it to win it. The early acquisition of Taylor Ward adds a 36-homer bat to the lineup, even if Ward, a free agent after 26, is simply a rental. And since Alonso was tendered a qualifying offer by the Mets last season, Elias doesn't have to surrender a coveted draft pick as compensation. Now to find an ace. Also a winner, Mets infield defense. A Pyrrhic victory? Club president David Stearns identified improving the defense as a key offseason goal and walked that walk in trading veteran Met Brandon Nemo to the Texas Rangers for defensively elite Marcus Semien, who will supplant Jeff McNeil. Alonso's minus 9 outs above average ranked 39th out of the 40 qualifying first basemen. So, be it Mark Vientos or somebody else, the defense should be far improved on the right side of the infield. The lineup? Well, check back in January. Another winner, Kyle Tucker. Another big boy is off the board. And to a club that typically doesn't swim in the nine-figure contract waters, a handful of massive market teams are getting antsy. The Mets' current outfield consists of Juan Soto, Tyrone Taylor, and McNeil, while the 2-3-4 of the lineup goes to Semien, Soto, and Vientos. Can the Mets carry $1 billion worth of corner outfielders? Tucker may get the chance to find out as the Toronto Blue Jays, the presumed favorite to reel in this winter's top prize, may find competition as the moneyed and desperate run out of options to improve or even simply maintain. Now for the losers. First, owners who like to cry poor. Yes, a team that's not from New York, Philly, Chicago, or LA can get a big deal done. We saw evidence of that when the Orioles matched the Phillies' $150 million outlay for Kyle Schwarber, and the Pirates and Cincinnati Reds checked in at around $120 million. Then again, we always knew they were capable. Alonso's pact isn't even a franchise record for total value, falling short of Chris Davis's $161 million deal in 2016. The Reds once signed Joey Votto to a $225 million extension. The Pirates? Surely they've biggie-sized a few meals over the years, but you get the idea. Point is, it's been an interesting winter preceding what everyone assumes will be the nuclear one. Lower revenue teams showing out in the market. Who knows if there's variance grievance avoiding, fan appeasing, darker motives to it all. But believe it or not, the money is out there. Things can be done. Another loser, David Stearns. When he was hired by the Mets, it looked for all the world like he'd be Andrew Friedman East, taking his smaller market chops and combining it with Steve Cohen's bottomless trove of cash to create a smart and spending club to rival Friedman's Dodgers. And when, in a reloading year, Stearns' Mets pushed the Dodgers to Game 6 of the National League Championship Series, they seemed well on their way. And then added Juan Soto for a cool $765 million. Stearns already tried ducking Alonso a year ago when he festered on the market while tied to draft pick compensation, only for a summit with owner Steve Cohen to smooth things over and bring him back one more year, a year when he hit 38 homers with an 871 OPS. Yet this time he had no interest in a longer-term commitment. That's fine, we all have our tastes, but going forward, Stearns may be wise to heed the words of Friedman, who in 2017 pivoted from the guy trying to achieve value with every transaction into the bloodless exec who now produced consecutive World Series championships. If you're always rational about every free agent, he said at the 2016 winter meetings, you will finish third on every free agent. And I'm afraid that's all we have time for today, fans. So this is Kent Batty, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, signing off and wishing you a warm and restful holiday.